Institute of Education in London at the Department of Language, Curriculum and Communication. Her research combines a sociological and psychoanalytic approaches to explore knowledge practices in higher education. In particular, she's worked looking at recontextualizing psychoanalytic concepts into social research and doing empirical research on the relationship between academic authors and their practice. So today she's going to present us a really engaging and thought-provoking paper, Loading Up Meanings and Covering Over Desire, Higher Education as an Empty Signifier.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start off with just by saying a bit about bits of paper. I panicked. I was trying to get out of my written paper, and so I've done a handout. I didn't realize everybody would actually have a copy of the full paper. And so you may not want more bits of paper. There's a handout that I will kind of be roughly following. It mostly in the handout, it just has some extracts of data that I'll stop hopefully at. So they're in the paper as well, but in case it's useful, then have one. And if it's too much paper, it's probably nothing that you haven't already got. I think, as Susan said at the beginning, it's as much a crutch for me as possibly of any help to anyone else, but about her. And I just wanted to sort of start by going, because having had the two sessions in the morning, which I found both really interesting and really useful. I think it's always useful to listen to these different bits of the context of what you're looking at. I certainly, when I'm looking at something, forget completely about the fact that there is other people exploring the context in these productive ways. And I thought there were some really helpful to me resonances with the paper that I've been working on. I thought in particular the way Susan this morning was talking about the power of the symbolic imaginary, she said, is the idea of the knowledge economy. And I think that idea of the symbolic imaginary, sort of the symbolic power of these kind of discursive constructions is really very close to what I'm exploring in the paper here now. And also Valerie Orkadine's discussion about the need for a more complex understanding of the subjectivities that are constructed or may not be totally constructed by that interaction between subjectivity and discourse and those interrelations. I think, and the need for those to be situated, I think she said, within more specific discursive contexts. I think, again, it's something that I feel I need to think about within my own work. And also something Louise said at the very beginning, where she talked about the way that academic identities are produced between, I think she said, the archaism of sort of the traditional conceptions of the academic, and I don't remember exactly what word you used. I scribbled. I wrote right on her hypermodernity, so I was living in hypermodernization, and I thought, oh well, she could certainly have done my paper for me, and that would be, you know, sort of save me. So I think there are sort of all these really nice chains going through, hopefully, and I think some of these things kind of resonate with what I'm trying to think about. So I'm going to sort of go in and out of the bits of the writing that that you've got a copy of, and I am going to start, I think, just by thinking about the title that we were set for today, because I'm being a good girl and kept going back to the title as I was writing my paper, trying to make it fit. And the question that we were given was, who desires and aims for higher education? And I did think about this, it kind of intrigued me when I got the question, and I thought about it quite a lot. So one thing I thought about was a possible relationship that suggests between desires and aims, and wondering about whether this is ever, in fact, a linear relationship, so, you know, I desire something and therefore I aim for it, or whether we can think about this in a more, slightly more complicated way, and think of this relation as overdetermined through sort of social and symbolic relations. And I sort of indicated in my title one way of understanding desire as a force that's covered over or disguised in the meanings that we attribute to higher education. And I hope that I'll sort of be able to sort of elaborate that as I go through the paper, what the, sort of the meaning of that conception of desire. I was also really sort of intrigued and troubled by the brackets in the title. Because they suggest different possibilities, possible readings, of course. And with four left in the sentence, we get this sort of slightly odd-sounding phrase, who desires for higher education? And so that sort of disrupts the norm, who desires higher education, who desires for higher education? And I sort of thought, well, it's almost like higher education doesn't desire for itself, there's a desire outside of or beyond higher education. And I think that's kind of quite a useful way of thinking of desire as this thing beyond, this kind of force outside of the sort of named object. And we can also omit the for, which gives us who aims higher education. So, you know, very obviously that connotes, you know, a gun or another weapon that is aimed in a battle. And obviously within higher education, you know, there is a range of battles, the class battle, the cultural battle, or battles for status and power. So I was thinking about who and what kinds of interests might be at stake in the battle that takes higher education as a weapon. And again, I thought as I was listening this morning that there was a sense quite often of higher education being constructed as a battle, as a weapon in the battle for by these different policymakers and individuals. Individuals, institutions and governments get something out of their affiliations with the signifier of higher education and with the meanings that are attached to it. And I think that's quite a useful starting point. So academics, for example, we get our income, hopefully, our intellectual identity and our social and professional status through affiliation with an idea of higher education. And universities, deliverers of higher education, gain access to funding on the basis of an affiliation to a particular aspect or idea of higher education. And governments justify policies on the basis of evidence provided through research which is legitimized because it's produced within an institution of higher education. So all of these identities in academics and universities and governments depend in a way for their identity or on some kind of conception of higher education. And they're vulnerable if this shifts in some way. Clearly, yes, academics depend on like, status, institutions for funding, and governments to legitimize policies. And I think it's kind of also important to note that in terms of governments, there is an aspect that they want to rely on the kind of a scholarly nature and the scientific nature of what is produced within higher education institutions. But they also need to be flexible enough to meet with different kinds of initiatives, to support different kinds of initiatives. So they may not always, I suppose all of these different constituencies might at different times want different bits of higher education to be foregrounded in order to support their identities. And they're all vulnerable, therefore, and put in peril by sort of the leakage of identity that might be enforced as a meaning of higher education shifts. So in a way, we could think of all these identities as using meanings attached to the signifier of higher education to defend against the vulnerability of their identities. And then any shift in the meaning of higher education becomes a site of contestation within which individual and institutional identities may feel threatened or may see the prospect of enhanced legitimacy and security. So this is this process of contestation, the struggle to hegemonize meanings of higher education is what I want to explore in this paper. And in doing this, I want to foreground both the symbolic relations within which the struggle take place, but also the affective and with an A, not an effective, I'm not really interested in effective higher education, but sort of the more emotional forces that are present within these symbolic relations. And to do this, I'm looking at three empirical instances. So firstly, I'm going to give a sort of gloss, an exposition of Rosa Burgos's analysis of the position of theory in higher education policy and curricula. This is the first bit on your handout, by the way. It's got these bullet points. And then I'm going to talk about the new government proposals for a Masters in Teaching and Learning, which some of you may have heard of or may not have. I'll explain when I get there. But I want to argue that the proposals, the government proposals, constitute a site of contestation over the place of theory, practice, and professional development in the discursive construction of higher education. And finally, I'm going to go to my own current sort of empirical study, which explores academics' affective relations to their knowledge practices. And I use that project uses unstructured interviews to explore these affective relations within higher education. And I'm just at the start of that project, so this is really a very preliminary analysis. The plan is to interview each of my participants sort of 6 or 8 times. I've only interviewed a maximum of 3 times so far, so it's kind of a very preliminary exploration. So finally, before going on to talk about these empirical instances, I just thought I wanted to say something a little bit about positioning within the paper, because I am using a sort of more abstractive theoretical language, and what this language does is to foreground sort of higher education theory and practice as de-essentialized identities. So they're signifiers which are filled with meaning through hegemonizing discursive practices that constitute the appearance of essence or the appearance of naturalness to something that doesn't really exist external outside of these discursive practices. But my institutional position as an academic constitutes me as a subject of these practices, with my own personal and political investments in particular sets of relations between, for example, theory and higher education. I have an investment in, you know, to what extent theory is central to higher education and the way that's thought about. I don't think these are totally contradictory positions, but I think they suggest that the way that we think about conceptualizing what we were asked to say, conceptualizing the university of the future, needs to be explicitly strategic, and we need to explicitly try to avoid unhelpful idealizations or essentialized versions of higher education that in fact work to cover over our own investments in our current institutional, intellectual, class, and gendered identities. And I think obviously Valerie's paper pointed very much to the way in which higher education practice currently does support particular investments of class and gendered identities. And I think that those are the kinds of things that we need to be alert to in articulating a vision for higher education. Okay. So I will start off by just talking a little bit about Rosa Burgos's analysis of the place of theory in educational policy and curricula. I'm drawing on an article she wrote in the International Review of Education, where she explores what she says is the changing place of theory as a signifier in educational policy and curricula. She presents a series of instances that she suggests illustrate a tendency to underplay the significance of theoretical work in policy documents, funding recommendations, and curriculum guidance. She argues that in the policy documents that she looks at, either theory is simply not present, or where theory is present, it gets attached to negative meanings, such as not being real, being sort of not getting your hands dirty, indirect, distant from real educational problems. And she says, yes, not the non-theoretical then appears as natural, good, and able to offer direct solutions to policy difficulties. So for example, she looks at the curriculum guidance that's produced for Latin American countries. And so it's quite a detailed plan, she says, of sort of the curriculum and teaching methods. It doesn't mention theory. It just says this is a good way of doing things. And she says that underlying the theory, underlying the sort of the suggestions in this plan, are clearly behaviorist principles. But the place of theory is suppressed, and suggestions that are based on what is a very highly contentious area of theory are presented as natural. And uncontroversial. And so the plan presents curricula and teaching methods as uncontroversial and cover over these very heated professional and academic debates. So theory is kind of displaced and not taken to be as important, and also sort of recontextualized to be uncontentious within policy documents. The instance that she explores in most detail in the in the paper is the change in the curriculum of a program for doctoral students in an education department in a Mexican university. And what she describes is how when the program was first devised in 1975, theory was absolutely central. Everyone had to do theory. Theory was a core part of the program, and it had a sort of proper amount of time allotted to it. And gradually, between 1975 and 1998, theory is displaced. It becomes an optional part of the course and has less time allotted to it, and more time is allotted to methods. And sort of, what does she say, empirical research competence. And what she says, I sort of think is an interesting part of this story, or a bizarre part of the story, is that the department that she's talking about, the staff in this department, are all in fact closely aligned with highly theorized research practice. So she sort of lists there, so she lists Piagetian psycholinguistics, Bourdieu sociology, psychoanalysis, ethnography. And so there's a department full of highly theoretical staff members, or highly theorized sort of research practitioners, who nevertheless, with it under their watch, you know, come up with a de-theorized doctoral research program. I mean, this is interesting. I think that this sort of strange juxtaposition perhaps leaves it open to us to speculate on the force of the discursive regulations, the kinds of policies and the sort of documents and policies and the discourses within these policies that she's looked at elsewhere, and the way that there's force that comes from these policies outside of the department into the department. Is there some relation? That's obviously what she's suggesting. And this shift, the shifting of theory out of the curriculum and the shifting of the theory out of policy, both therefore have sort of implications for higher education more broadly, because the place of theory in relation, you know, the place of the university and the possible contribution that the university might make to policy might be based on its theoretical orientation, and similarly its sort of support for the kinds of practices, the kinds of knowledge practices we have within the university are obviously closely related with these other practices, so that it's what a university can or should be is partly determined by these kinds of practices, policy practices outside of the university. Okay, so just to kind of emphasize briefly, I think that what Burgos' analysis suggests is the desire to shed uncertain and ambivalent aspects of the policy process and to distance the process from explicit affiliations, so these might be theoretical commitments or ideological commitments, which seem or are made to bear vulnerable aspects of responsibility and potential failure. Or to put it another way, they cover over the impossibility of achieving policy objectives. So theory, from sort of the perspective of someone like Žižek or from Lacan and Mies, would come to stand in for the structural lack in the symbolic system, the impossibility of finding policy solutions to interminable social antagonisms. This allows the construction of a fantasy of policy as direct, practical, and able to potentially cure social ills. The fantasy is emptied of difficult emotions, which are thus suppressed or displaced in the chains of meanings articulated within the policy process. From a Lacanian perspective, we are caught in the imaginary order when we fail to recognize the insignificance of our position and the essential incompleteness of the symbolic order of discourse. In Žižek's words, he says, fantasy is a means for an ideology to take its own failure into account in advance. Maybe the failure of the policy and process, the policymakers construct theory of bad and themselves is able to solve things. So the displacement of theory from educational policy and the loading of theory with significations of negativity and failure constitutes a fantasy, a position within the imaginary order that enables policy-making bodies to cover over or to disown the fragility of their own symbolic position. So that, I was just really, really intrigued when I read that article by Rosa Burgos, because partly because I do teach on quite a few doctoral programs, and the doctoral programs that I teach in indeed have displaced theory from being called components. And I'm aware of the ESRC, I think somebody asked a question in the morning about sort of the regulation of doctoral courses, and I don't know the details, I'm sure other people here know better than I, but I'm aware that sort of the ESRC-funded programs are quite, there's quite a detailed description for what they should and shouldn't include, and as I understand it, theory is not particularly prioritised in their specifications. I may be wrong, and I apologise to them, I berate them if I'm wrong, I'm not saying which one is right or wrong. So I think that you can certainly see this sort of Mexican example, as she's talking about Mexico, you can see very similar strands here. And then I just sort of came across these proposals and sort of saw similar kinds of continuities in when I sort of began to hear about the proposals for the Masters in Teaching and Learning, which is a current government proposal. And it's broadly, it's a proposal from the government that, that teaching should become a master's level profession, and so that eventually all teachers will have a master's. But what they're proposing is not that the teachers will all just choose from the array of masters on offer, or even the array of masters on your education on offer. And there are already many master's courses in teaching, master's courses in learning, master's courses in other areas of education. What they're proposing is one specific master's course, which all teachers would eventually do. And I think there's a tiny this broad context that's worth mentioning, which is the change in what master's level study means over the past, I don't know how many years, decades probably. Far more people do masters, and there are more professionally oriented masters. And some of these professionally oriented masters are not assessed at what might traditionally be thought of as master's level. So the theoretical component has shifted around, and so it's, for example, some MBA courses will have modules that are assessed at very, you know, very practical, based modules that aren't assessed, you know, via sort of integration of theory. This is purely anecdotal, but you know, things like certain computer aspects where people need computer skills but they have none, so they'll be getting part of their MBA through doing a relatively basic computer course, and that will count at master's level. Which, you know, we could debate the positives and negatives of that. So the MGL is a proposal, I'm quoting from DCFS, to improve the status and expertise of the teaching profession by making teaching a master's level profession. However, it's also a response to some specific difficulties identified within the current context, the concerns surrounding the recruitment and retention of teachers, and the possibility identified in recent government commissioning research that problems in this area might relate to the support available to teachers in their first few years of teaching. So the MGL is explicitly formulated to as a response to this, teachers reporting that they find the probationary year very difficult and that they don't have enough support, which therefore suggests that the MTL is a means of improving the support for teachers in teacher probationary year. And this constitutes the MTL and hence higher education as a form of induction and mentoring for public sector professionals. The delivery of this kind of service on behalf of government reconfigures higher education, reiterating some of its subordinating features and displacing traditionalist ideas or ideals regarding the autonomy of the field. So that's kind of the background of what the MTL is. And what I want to explore or begin to think about is the symbolic mechanisms by which the MTL proposals can be seen to condense a variety of meanings that, while still contested, are becoming more securely attached to the practice of higher education. These are, again, listed on your handout now. So there's three, and I'm only actually going to look in detail at the first of these, but for example, the symbolic mechanisms, as I said, the juxtaposition of references to higher education as a validating institution with conceptions of practice-based professional development. So that's one kind of symbolic mechanism. There's also the foregrounding of reflection, critical reflection, and practice as legitimate intellectual higher education level practices. And there's also the construction of effective practitioners as necessarily involved in continuous professional development. What I'm going to do is look at the first of these symbolic processes, the juxtaposition of references to higher education as a validating institution with conceptions of practice-based professional development. And if you look on the second page of your handout, there's a sort of quotation there, which comes from the government document introducing these proposals. There's being the best for our children, releasing talent for teaching and learning, is a DCFS document from 2008. And the quotation in the box comes sort of midway through the document, and it's already given the rationale for introducing this master's in teaching and learning, and then it's sort of explaining how this master's would be delivered. I don't know if you want a couple of seconds to glance your eye at just, I mean, you've just focused the stuff underneath, you don't need, but it's in the box. We could sort of pause and just have a thought about what they're doing symbolically. In that extract in relation to a conception of higher education within this master's course, or the role. Do you want me to storm on? Does anybody want to say anything that's occurred to them looking at what's in the box? This is the government, the DCFS, talking about this new Masters in Teaching and Learning that they hope all teachers will eventually do. I'm personally reasonably open minded, but I think you first needed to get that impression. And the position of the HIEI is kind of not elaborated in these bullet points. And the first bullet point, sorry, does anybody else want to say? No, that's really interesting. I haven't.
The franchise university don't get involved in franchise.
Yes. They don't. And then everyone else goes and does it. They train us once, yeah. Anything else anybody wants to point out about? And I think it's interesting. What I was going to point out is just, the way that higher education there, you've already said it, it's this validating, it validates the program, and it's mentioned in the first, not actually in the whole of the first bullet point, the first sentence, and then the rest of it is all about the role of the schools. And there are probably other points we could talk about, but that kind of key point, really. And what's interesting as well is that there have been various responses to these proposals from government by other kind of stakeholders, some positions within higher education, some more within teacher education, and they exactly replicate this kind of higher education as validating body, and then the rest of it is sort of practice in schools, and schools being the ones who can deliver the real, the stuff that will have a practical effect. So I suppose, I've asked in the paper, what are the effects of this juxtaposition of notions of practice and the role of higher education? And one effect of the normalisation of this sort of slightly anomalous juxtaposition. So the contiguity of the elements within the text sort of initiates a contiguity that might be taken for granted in other terrains. So the legitimacy of including practice-based elements within an MA program, the necessity for partnership to ensure the practical focus of the degree. You need to have partners outside. They don't like the ivory towers. And the legitimacy of non-university staff in delivering university-validated courses are all presented in a neutral, normalizing tone within the text. And any notion of the specialist expertise that university staff might have in the delivery of MA-level conceptual understanding is suppressed, as is the possibility that staff outside the school and universities might perhaps be able to deliver a course with an appropriate practical focus. So the dispersive effect here is quite similar to that described by Burgos, in that theory is displaced and practice-based approaches are presumed to deliver the solutions to policy difficulties in countering the vision of universal education systems. And the other effect, which I think is interesting, I think somebody just mentioned, is this sort of the both reduction and idealization of the conception of the university. It's reduced to just a quality assurance mechanism, but it's also idealized as something which can deliver quality assurance, when in fact, there are, this sort of wipes out the inevitable limits of any quality assurance system, dealing with sort of these very elusive conceptual standards, increasing numbers and shifting practices. And I think that there's an effective force present but suppressed within this kind of signifying move. Professional identities, academic special identities and teacher special identities are very closely bound up with notions of judgment and expertise. So the devaluing of theoretical expertise jeopardizes the identity and status of academics. While you might argue that the recognition of classroom, the practical classroom expertise would enhance the professional status of practitioners, but it might also burden them with unspecified new responsibilities. And the disabling effects of this radical blurring of boundaries between previously distinct practices is not really acknowledged within the text, or it's not acknowledged at all within the text. And similarly, the fears inherent in the policy process that produce the reduction idealization of the university are not acknowledged. So the university covers over the worry, oh my god, this might not be MA level. If they validate it, it will be all okay. So there's obviously some kind of affective force there. I was going to say a little bit more about reflective practice, but I'm getting to the end. I'm going to jump to, yeah, I can say that later about the way that identities are bound up, academic identities are also bound up, teacher educators, particularly in universities, and the debates around reflective practice and critical reflection have a significant impact, I think, on the identities of teacher educators within higher education. But what I want to do then is have time to look at least one of the extracts from my current research, but it was academic. And sorry, I'm now just clicking through to find the right place. So I'm looking at my current research, and I'll go as far as I can. I've got two case studies here, and they're participants talking about their responses to regulative institutionalized aspects of academic practice. And in both cases, it seems to me that there's a sense of the brutality of institutionalized regulation. The word brutal may seem excessive, perhaps, from some theoretical perspective. And the reason that I'm using the term is that in each instance, there's a sense of an antagonistic psychical engagement between the participant and the forces that define and regulate their day-to-day practice. There's also a sense within the data of participants not wanting to admit to being brutalized, which may be interpreted as an act of resistance, but at the same time, perhaps, as a defensive covering over of the wounds that the regulative system inflicts. So I'll start off by talking about participant A. I'll say a little bit and then we'll come to the text. So in his first interview, participant A talked about how he enjoyed spending time over the wording of sentences in his writing and how this has become more central to his approach to writing. And having talked about this for a while, he said, yeah, I've got an interest in allowing in any text the written style to be important or to take up as much time as the actual research or reading of the theoretical material. However, he also described this as problematic, or potentially problematic, referring several times to his worried about wasting time, or saying, I've got less worried about wasting time. I've allowed myself to relax into it. So there seemed to be a struggle between a sense of ongoing pressures related to his job and a desire to resist these pressures. And he separates out these opposing forces in his talk, referring to the current environment for producing research, but also talking about his own preference for spending time over his writing. So you've got the first extract on the handout, sort of extract one, participant A, where he says, I'm an incredibly slow writer. It takes me days to write paragraphs. And in many ways, that's a problem, because that's not the current environment for producing research, as I'm sure you know. But on the other hand, that's how I like to do it. And I increasingly don't give myself a hard time about the fact that I'm spending a long time writing a sentence, because I want to write it that way. And I think it's difficult to interpret the extent to which these two forces that he refers to within, or sort of constructed within participant A's talk, the current environment and how I like to do it, might be separable or might actually be inextricably entangled. He appears to be making quite a strong claim that he's overcome his worries about the speed at which he produced this research, but at the same time, the references to worry suggest quite a strong emotional involvement in this aspect of his work. And my intervention in the section of the interview picked up on his use of the term worry, and his response first elaborated on the pressures that might give rise to the sense of worry, and then reiterated some of his sense about the ways in which he might give himself a hard time. Sorry, I'm rushing there. So this is in extract two. He kind of talks, I suppose my question that sort of foregrounds what he's talking about wasting time and his worry and berating himself. And he pauses before answering, and then he first of all talks about the pressures and the projects and the pressure to knock things off quickly, and he feels this pressure. And then he kind of, I sort of underline bits, and he says, not that I give myself a hard time, but he's again saying he doesn't give himself a hard time. I actually think it's important to do these things. But then he says maybe an external pressure, so he kind of externalizes the pressure. but then there are these other projects competing for my attention. So it's as if these projects are outside of him, demanding that he does things rather than them being his own project. So there's kind of a separation between, or a strange relationship that we might think about between inner and outer, or a construction of inner and outer. And so at the end he says a hard time, more in the sense that I should be giving myself a harder time than I do, if that makes sense. I possibly ought to rush on to how much my 5 minutes. I was going to say, does anybody want to? Okay, I've got about 1 minute. Okay. Well, I'll then just sort of summarize up on this and some, and then go a little bit to the conclusion of that. Okay. So there seems to be a tussle going on here between an acknowledgement of ongoing pressures of the job and an articulation of a self that does not respond to these pressures. And when he says it's not really that I give myself a hard time, the external and his phrasing, the point of my interpretation really is not to suggest that academics should be free of the regulative institutional constraints, but rather suggest the complex ways in which our subjectivities become entwined within these constraining discourses. And I wonder whether perhaps the brutality of these processes is much in the attempt to articulate a disinterested autonomous identity that can be set free of the regulative system as it is in the imposition of the regulative system itself. Because there's this sense of him trying to construct this identity of what I want to do as somehow separate to these external pressurizing forces that he concentrates, that he sort of also articulates. And it's like he's trying to sort of cut himself an identity out of the sort of symbolic social networks. And then very similar kinds of things happened with and the other participant, which I'm afraid I've sort of missed time, so I can't refer to, but he was talking about, first of all, what was he talking about? Oh, quite interesting, he's talking about a book written by a journalist, and the struggles he has with that, but then also very much talking about the struggles of being regulated by the RAE, and then trying to resist that, and trying to sort of cut out or carve out an identity that is able to refuse the pressures, or say that it can refuse the pressures of the RAE, and both of them denying, sort of expressing worry or emotion or affect, and then quickly covering it over, which I think, again, somebody mentioned this morning, this kind of denial of affect, which is quite interesting, in the construction of this apparently autonomous self. So in each of the three empirical instances that I've kind of just rushed through, that's Burgos' analysis of the displacement of theory in educational policy and in the doctoral program, and the policy documents relating to the Masters in Teaching and Learning, and in the interview data produced in my study, my analysis intended to suggest a psychical force that displaces affective intensities as meanings are shifted from one signifier onto another. The product of this displacement is the cutting up of the subjectivities and of knowledge. Subjectivity and knowledge are cut up into naturalized pockets emptied of affect, controversy, and the complexity of discursive social relations. The leftover affect is deposited onto divided subjectivities that struggle to produce themselves as the autonomous identities required within the discursive norms of the university. And I suppose really that what I'm overall trying to look at is the way that higher education is constituted between these complex competing forces that are displaced or covered over in the signifiers of theory or practice, autonomy or accountability. And I'm kind of out of time now, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now let's open it for questions and comments. Maybe we can take three other times, definitely. So any questions?
Thank you very much, Claudia. I'm just wondering whether you have got any data from academics who reflect back on themselves, that very cut up-edness.
Hold the question.
Hold the question. Okay. Thank you very much. I wanted to comment on the MTL section, in which I've been involved involved on the edges of MTL development over the last few months. This is the first time I've had any attempt to theorize it. So that really is excellent, thank you. And what I wanted to say was, if you are going to look into this in more detail, which I think would be incredibly helpful, I think you need to look at what's been happening in the initial teacher education programs over the last few years, with the introduction of master level credits into PGCE and the development of the graduate teacher program, the GTP. So I think you'll find already that teachers and schools are marking master's level work accredited by universities. So I think it's been creeping in over the last few years almost unnoticed, but it really does need a lot of work. Thank you.
Kirsty.
Yes, thank you for your speech and also the other speakers. I have enjoyed very much all the papers. The picture that you bring about this higher education improvements, it's one gets really sad and frustrated. I mean, like who would like to find her or his inner coach? You know what I mean? So that, what are we striving for? This is like, if I'm as a feminist agent, I shouldn't be inside academia if it is like this. So there are also a lot of effects that come to mind when listening to your speeches and also reading your data. And so, like the guy in Valerie's data that didn't want to, he was willing to clean but not wanting. This is the same reaction almost coming to one's mind. So, not a question really, but a comment. How do you feel, perhaps?
I'm sorry. Okay. Trying to escape from the at the beginning of the study, sorry, Valerie, your question about whether any academics reflect back on themselves. I think in the paper I do have a quotation from a female, like these are both male academics. And I think there is a gendered, but I do only have the three participants at the moment, but the female academic I've interviewed so far was much more articulate about the pain and the difficulty, and also very articulate about the very, very severe regulation imposed by disciplinary, institutionalized disciplines on what you can do. But not anyone who, as yet, but then it's also who I've selected, I suppose, so far, that... that has explicitly, I think there may be a little bit of reflection coming, and one of the points of the project is that people will learn how to do it, because we're interviewing them 6 to 8 times. So I think there may be a bit more reflection back coming, but I'd need to look at the data more before that. That's very interesting, yes, as I think you were saying about the MTL and the M-level. And I had been thinking, as I was thinking this morning, listening to two papers about how would, this is so preliminary, and you could do it by interviewing, expand this exploration of the MTL. I was thinking this morning about need to look more at the process, of the policy making process, and interview, you know, people at the TDA or, you know, Ed Ball, people in the DCSF. But then I sort of, from what you're saying as well, it's about thinking about maybe some way of getting at those, the way that is, those regular shifts in the boundaries of the practice of teachers in schools, you could go and just see what that is doing to them. Because I've speculated here, you know, I said, oh, well, maybe they don't like it, but, you know, I think that would be really, really interesting. I think it's so familiar that I don't find it, I quite enjoy doing it, so it's kind of, but I think in general, and I think this is really a question maybe we should need to all come back to, is what do we do from here? What is the role of the academic? And I think that what I've tried to argue is that we need to be reflexive about what we want and try to recognise where it is a kind of a self-indulgence and where it is something that we really do want to fight for. And I think that those get terribly confused within the debates about what higher education should be. And people feel terribly threatened by any shift in practice. And very often there's recourse to these very traditional ideals, sort of quite sort of liberal humanist ideals about learning, which may well be worth sticking to, but need to be thought through that we're not just protecting ourselves. And I also, in looking at this data, it's made me reflect back on some of my own position, which comes from, I came into higher education quite late. I was, prior to that, never had a secure job, sort of was a TEFL teacher working, sort of teaching 30 hours. And so to me, this is a dream job. You know, it's kind of fantastic. And sometimes when there is the continual moaning within higher education, I can be quite, well, don't you know how, what a good time you've got. And so what's been useful for me in doing this is actually reflecting back on how that itself, my own position, is itself a psychical construction that I need to take apart a little bit more. So that was, I don't know if that responds to your question.
Well, I was just struck in reading about the Masters in Teaching, when you're talking about Masters in Teaching and Learning, which I didn't know about, actually. I didn't know they were going to do this. But and the extract you gave us said something about the anxiety on the part of the probationary year teachers. And I was just wondering if that covered over another anxiety, which is about the anxiety of schools falling apart and the impossibility of education, which has somehow got reworked into the understandable anxiety of probationary year teachers, which can then be addressed by a master's degree, if you see what I mean. And so I was wondering about the interplay of desires and anxieties. And I should have said thank you very much for the paper, which I enjoyed very much.
It's just a kind of bit of whimsy, really, but I remember Laurie Taylor. He, you know, in his Thinking Aloud program, he mentioned a paper, and it was an investigation of universities, and it was an anthropological investigation, and the researcher kept going away and said, but these academics, they're not saying anything. All they're doing is complaining. And he said somebody revisited the data and reinterpreted what complaining was about as a desperate attempt for a fragile solidarity. So the complaint culture is the only space, given how rampant it is with competition, neoliberalism, kind of a viciousness and an increasingly visceral nature of our relations, how they infect the interpersonal, that the complaint culture may be this doing a hell of a lot around anxiety, displacement, and so on and so forth. Kind of an observation to build into your analysis.
This is really a comment on the first episode, the first sequence that you try to advance, and around the research training and so on. And one of the things that I've observed, and maybe very specific to Bristol, is that other departments in Bristol were able to hold on to quite an amount of theory, sociology, geography, explicit theories of space, politics, theories of social justice. And what happened for me, which was very interesting about education, is that it somehow just got left without any theory, as if, and what I did wonder is whether there was something about education departments and maybe the face-off between the psychologists and the sociologists that actually ended up with a theoryless master's in research training when other departments didn't. So there is something to do with the kinds of knowledge and the politics of education departments or faculties that actually I think delivered something very particular as opposed to these research training courses in general. That's just a comment or an observation.
uh,
I guess it's going back a bit to the quote that you didn't have a chance to look at. Because thinking about what you were just saying, I think one of the splits that I've noticed at the Institute is between MA, people who teach on MA programs and people who teach on PGCE programs. And the idea of reflective practice as something that is this way by which PGCE tutors kind of retain legitimacy over being academics whilst actually being constantly challenged on that basis. You know, for example, they haven't got enough publications for the RAE. And so how this, I think what provoked it was that the idea that that higher education is too theoretical is something I've heard so often within higher education. And sometimes from people who teach on PGCE, and you can see it very much as a defensive move, you know, a way of defending their own kind of position or legitimacy within the institution. And I was wondering how this argument over reflection and over theory kind of, I guess, exploded real tensions within universities, and not just between, I guess, universities and policymakers. Okay. I mean, really, those first three points, I think I just say thank you, because I don't think, I mean, I think that Valerie W. Wolpertine, that yes, I completely think that this is a covering over of the general anxieties and the sort of this myth or non-myth about the falling apart of education and the anxiety surrounding that, and it's just pushed over into this thing that can block over those. So I think that's absolutely and helpfully put. And similarly, you said about the complaints culture and what work that's doing is something I probably and I think that issue about what happens, what's particular to education departments, because I think that it is clearly a very distinctive specific site where these different disciplines come together, as I think, as I said, it was a comment, but it's clearly pertinent that you have to look at the specificity of different sites as to how the external discourses that are shifting the meaning of higher education are sort of taken up in different ways in those. And I think what I'm really interested, I've only just really become interested in this sort of the academic debates or the published debates in academic journals around this notion of reflect. And I think it's such a difficult, I mean, as I'm reading them now, there's this terribly complex negotiation going on where people have to kind of diss certain concepts of reflective practice as untheoretical, not good enough, clearly sort of too self-oriented, and then justify other conceptions of reflective practice. And also at the same time distance themselves from the government whilst in fact their discourse precisely mirrors what the government is saying, because they're trying to carve out this space where what they do is indeed legitimate within higher education, but they're also not tainted by the governmental discourses on the RA education that traditional academics constantly refuse. And you almost think that it would be more comfortable for some of the people in these liminal positions to be able to say, well, yeah, that bit of the government, you know, that's what I'm doing. That's fantastic, hurrah, the government's supporting me at last. But they can't do that. And I think that's really fascinating, those really complicated sort of and I do genuinely not feel that I'm an expert on a teacher professional. I mean, I'm not in any way, but it's teacher professional development, and these people are more. So they're put in this complicated position where they're feeling not quite fitting. They're dedicated to a particular kind of practice that from other positions in the university, it doesn't seem like what is traditionally thought of.
It's not really a question, it's just a point in relation to the aterialization of the doctoral education and maybe even master's as well, because I don't remember actually having 2 years when I did my master's. That has to join with Susan Robson's point that it's not just a dispute between sociology and psychology, but it's who is going to have the power and what is education there for. If the funding are demanding that it has to be deteriorized, so why is that they are demanding it? Because the research is going to be influenced, used to influence policy. And policy is not a site for theory, because you don't want anybody grabbing issues and having a fight about are going to apply or not. And when you look at the teaching books for university lecturers to learn to teach, there is no theory there, apart from cognitive psychology pointing out that you should teach this way because that is the way that the students are going to learn. And the policy, and when you see that most of the research that professors and researchers in higher education are doing are all funded by the government, and they all have a political issue behind. So who has the power? And clearly the power is coming down to the education where theory is not used for explaining it.
Sit down and you'll think of something. mine was linking right back. You sound a bit of a slow learner. Right back to the comment that Valerie made about, and one question I have, which is the privatization of dissent. And when you were talking about evacuating the affect, whether the complaints culture is the affect taking back in, have a public performance of a private enactment, the anger, the anxiety, etc. And I'm wondering if it's the kind of the shadow of the out of the UK and quality and all this in the UK, and it doesn't matter where, which country, I'm always asked that the UK accepted and has complied with culture so profoundly. Why has there been so little resistance and so much performance and enactment and ventriloquy of neoliberal walkout? And I think people recognize it's safer to comply. You complain and you resist and you find another space in which to let out some of those feelings.
If I may, I'd like to come back to the title of your paper, Higher Education as Empty Signifier, and then looking at the last bullet point in that government statement saying participants would be expected to undertake some study in their own time. So that for me calls in the idea of are the aims of the academic different from the aims of government and policymakers and the rest of the society? So talking about who desires and aims for higher education, our aims are internal actor of higher education opposed to other people's aims? Because when I see the last statement, I really wonder what is their view of what a master should be and how higher education is understood by people who are not within the system.
I think it was just a comment really, wasn't it? But I think it's, again, it's just very, very interesting the way that what counts as theory is one of the battles that's going on here. The role of disciplines in relation to an applied field of practice outside the academy probably makes sense, and education so clearly has an applied field of practice. So some disciplines will have a less explicit field of practice. I thought the way you put it, Louis, so I don't really care your nice image of complaints as the sort of the shadow of the compliance culture. I think that's again really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what I mean by the empty signifier is that it needs to be constructed as something. And I think that when I was talking about the different positionalities that we have as a kind of theorist looking over, I suppose I'm trying to say, you know, there is no essential to higher education. Any kind of conception of higher education needs to be formulated explicitly as a strategic intervention rather than as something that it obviously should be. And I think that we're inducted into higher education through our training, which means that when we look at participants would be expected to undertake some study in their own time, we go, blimey, at a minimum, or, you know, and I think that's where you have to sort of tease out your desire, or my desire, maybe not yours, to stick to sort of an understanding of it as non-essentialized, and where's my emotional response here? Where's my response that is protecting my own existing position? And where is this something that actually, yes, I do hold on to? And actually, yes, you know, there is some importance to assuming that higher level study will have study in their own time. So I think it's kind of teasing those things out. But yes, will they manage, or have they already managed to shift the idea that a master's does require some independent study? I mean, I don't know whether that, how well adhered that is to the concept of higher education at the moment.
Well, thank you very much for interesting questions. Thank you for presenting your paper and discussing with us. We have run out of time at the moment, but I think if you have more questions, then we can maybe take them in the general discussions.
Thank you.